All right, John, the fourth chapter, and we're going to wrap that up here tonight, I suspect, and we've gone through the conversation that Jesus has had with the Samaritan woman. We've covered all that in detail, and we've got down to verse 43, where it says, in the 2 days, after 2 days rather, that is the 2 days that he spent with the people of Samaria, after 2 days, it says that he departed for Galilee. And we remember that that, of course, was where he was heading in the very first place. Back over at the very beginning of the chapter, you might remember in verse 1, says, now when Jesus learned that the Pharisees had heard that Jesus was making and baptizing more disciples than John, although Jesus himself did not baptize, but only his disciples, he left Judea and departed again for Galilee. So we emphasize that he was leaving Judea specifically because of the Pharisees now turning their attention to him. And it wasn't that he was afraid of the Pharisees or the Jewish leaders in any way, but they did have the authority to cause trouble and to have him arrested and that sort of thing. And it just wasn't time for that as he's beginning his ministry. And so it was best for him to leave Judea, not that he could get away from them completely, but that's where, of course, they had the most influence there in Judea. And so he leaves there and he goes into Galilee because John has been arrested at this time, and that leaves kind of a void there. And that's where he will spend most of his ministry from anyway. And so we'll see that as we go along. And so we see he's departing for Galilee, but then we have all that we have studied here the last several class sessions, and with him, with the conversation with the woman at the well, the Samaritan woman. But now we pick up then at verse 43, where he finally, it says again, he departs for Galilee. For Jesus, verse 44, himself had testified that a prophet has no honor in his own hometown. So when he came to Galilee, the Galileans welcomed him, having seen all that he had done in Jerusalem at the feast, for they too had gone to the feast. His hometown, of course, was Nazareth. And he's gonna ultimately end up there briefly. He's rejected there, as can be predicted. But interestingly enough, he is received in Galilee. And he tells us why, John tells us why here. It's because a lot of the Galileans were in Jerusalem when he was there. And you remember, what great thing did he do in Jerusalem that you can recall just off the top of your head? What did he do when he was there? Come on now, don't make me go back. You know I like to review. Exactly right. He cleansed the temple. And that was a big deal for not only for Jesus, obviously. He was just being who he was and doing that. The zeal he had for his father and what was right. He was filled with righteous indignation, so he cleansed the temple. But he was a Galilean. Throughout the Gospels, he's known in several places. He's referred to as a Galilean because he was. That's what he was, where he was born and that area. And so this is kind of like him going back to Galilee. It's kind of like the hometown boy going home after defeating the big wigs in Jerusalem, when you stop and think about it. Who, behind the cleansing of the, remember everything we talked about with the cleansing of the temple, all the merchandise that they were doing, the selling and all of that, the high priest was behind all of that. And he was the great power in, behind religion and everything that was involved and going on in Jerusalem. And so cleansing the temple, though the high priest wasn't directly involved in that, he certainly, that would have been an assault in everybody's mind, an attack against the high priest. So this individual from Galilee, now he's, little place that comes from Galilee, and he comes and challenges the great authority in Jerusalem and obviously conquers them and drives them out of the temple and all of that. Now he comes back home, and the Galileans accept him, at least temporarily. They accept him. And we have other information about him returning to Galilee. Turn over to Luke chapter 4, and at verse 14, Luke refers to his return to Galilee in this way. He says, Luke 4 at verse 14, he says, and Jesus returned in the power of the Spirit to Galilee. And a report about him went out throughout all the surrounding country. And then verse 15, and he taught in the synagogue, being glorified by all. So it's good to get, you know, as I think I made mention just in passing last week, it's kind of hard to follow the chronology of Jesus. And of course, John, his intent is different than the Gospels. The Synoptic Gospels, they follow more of the personal ministry of Christ a little more closely. It is basically their Gospels is a synopsis of his personal ministry. But in the book of John, we see huge gaps. We see a lot of time passing rather quickly because John isn't interested really in that. His main focus, as we said from the beginning, is bringing up situations in the personal ministry of Christ where his deity is revealed, and he's trying to show people that when they read what he wrote, that they would see that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and in believing in him have eternal life. And so the fact is, 2/3 of this book of John is spent in the last week of Jesus. So, you know, there's a lot that we don't see with regard to his personal ministry. And so John's gospel is different than that. So it's kind of hard to follow what when we read this, it may seem like, you know, when we get to chapter 5, you'll see it seems like it's happening, it's all in order and that sort of thing, where in reality there's a huge space of time between chapter 4 and chapter 5. And if you just read John, you don't really see that. So he goes into Galilee. After he leaves Samaria, he goes into Galilee and he's doing some preaching and he's going into the synagogues and preaching and that sort of thing. In fact, over in Mark chapter 1, we have, along with Matthew chapter 4, in both of those passages, we see what it is that he's preaching when he gets into Galilee. Look at Mark chapter 1, down at verse 14, it says, and now after John was arrested, Jesus came into Galilee, proclaiming the gospel of God. What did he proclaim? Saying, the time is fulfilled and the kingdom of God is at hand. Repent and believe in the gospel. And so he had a message of repentance, is what he was going into the synagogues and preaching. Repent, because the kingdom is about to be established. The kingdom is at hand. That would be big news for the Jews, of course. But that was his message, at least in part. That was the primary thing that he was emphasizing as he went from place to place. All right, go back over to John then. Let's just go forward here in his narrative in John chapter 4. It says again, he was welcomed by the Galileans, having seen all that he had done in Jerusalem at the feast. For they had gone to the feast. And then he gets into this healing that John wants to, a sign that John wants to reveal to us. So he came, verse 46, he came again to Cana in Galilee, where he had made the water wine. We all remember that, of course. And at Capernaum, there was an official whose son was ill. And some translations have the word royal there, royal official. The King James, I think, calls him a nobleman. So this is an individual of repute. This is a man who has some clout, some power and prestige. And yet it says his son was ill. And we find as we go through this, of course, that he was close to death. His son was dying. And it just reminds us, of course, it really, these kind of things are something that's common to all man. It doesn't matter if you have power and prestige. Doesn't matter if you're rich or poor. Things happen in people's lives. And just because you're a nobleman, just because you're of royal descent, doesn't mean that your children aren't going to get sick or you're not going to get sick or whatever the case may be. So here is a man who's important and has some authority, a noble man. But his son gets sick. And so it says, when this man heard that Jesus had come from Judea to Galilee, he went to him and he asked him to come down and to heal his son, for he was at the point of death. And this was not an easy trip, of course. It was about 20 miles away, and that's in those days was a good little trip there. And but you obviously would do a lot more than that for your child who was dying. And so he makes this trip. He hears that Jesus is there. He knows of the some of the things that Jesus has done. He has heard of Jesus and obviously has some faith that he is able to help his son. And so he goes there. And it's interesting to me as we read this that he wants Jesus to come down to Capernaum and to heal his son. So here's a man who has faith, but he doesn't even realize how great Jesus is. I mean, Jesus is the Son of God. He's God manifested in the flesh. And so Jesus doesn't have to make that 20-mile trip back to Capernaum. If Jesus is inclined to heal his son, all he has to do is think it, and it's done. That's how powerful God is, of course. And while this man has faith, he doesn't really. It kind of reminds me of Ephesians 3 that we've often quoted, where Paul says that with regard to the power of God, he's able to do exceedingly, abundantly above all that we ask or think, that we can't even comprehend how great God is. And so clearly this man, he has some faith, though Jesus is about to give him a mild rebuke here. He has faith in Jesus. He believes he can heal his son, but he wants him to come back to Capernaum to do it. And so verse 48 is very interesting. It said, so Jesus said to him, unless you see signs and wonders, you will not believe. And so it's clear that this man has faith. I doubt that any of us would doubt that by the text here. And yet, you know, his faith could be stronger, and he probably has the same degree of faith that many people had and that many people have even today. Perhaps some of us even in the church, where Jesus implies here, you believe if you see. In other words, what would this man do you suppose, if Jesus said, no, I'm not going to heal your son? If he wasn't inclined to heal his son. He had the power to do it, but what if he didn't for whatever reason? And what Jesus seems to imply here, unless you see signs and wonders, you will not believe. And I stopped to think. This passage, as a matter of fact, helps me a lot. Help all of you who have had any kind of loss in your life that is very strong, very emotional. You stop and think of what is your attitude towards God when he says no to you. We've talked about prayer on Sunday morning, but when he says no, not just in regard to, as we have talked some about, maybe a promotion on the job or that sort of thing, but something that is very important to you. What's your attitude then? I've had to remind myself, God, when we prayed for my daughter, God said no. He's not going to, he wasn't going to or didn't save her. So what's my attitude? This sort of helped me. I have to say, listen, Don, are you like what Jesus is talking about here? Do you have to see in order to really believe? Do we believe in Jesus because of what he does for us outwardly? Or do we believe in Jesus because of who he is? That's really the bottom line with all of it. The fact of the matter is, you stop and think about it. God doesn't owe any of us anything in any realm, not spiritually or physically, but especially not physically. And when you pray, and we've again talked on Sunday mornings about prayer and how it's okay and appropriate to pray for physical things and that sort of thing. Nothing wrong with any of that. But anything that God does for you physically is icing. Yeah, I mean, it's extra. When you stop and think of all that God has done, he's done the most significant thing for all of us. He's taken care of the spiritual side of it, so that our souls can be saved and we can be redeemed and we can go to heaven after a while and we can have fellowship with him and his son right now. That's by far, it's not even close, that's by far the greater thing. And God did all of that by his grace and mercy. So he's already given you far more and given me far more than I ever deserve. So do I have the attitude? Well, but now still, God, I know you've done all of that. And I know it took your son, the sacrifice of your son, in order for me to have what I have spiritually. But God, I want you to answer this prayer. And if you don't, I'm just not going to believe in you quite as much. Is that the attitude that we have? And that's sort of what Jesus is implying, even with regard to this man who clearly has some faith in Jesus. But what if Jesus would have said to him, nope, I'm just going to let your son die? Would he still believe, or would he have left and had less confidence in Jesus or no confidence in Jesus at all? And so the only thing I'm saying to you now is all of us, I think we need to think about that in our real life. When you're asking God for things, and particularly in the physical realm or whatever it is, though, remember what God has done for you so far. And you should believe in God just because of who he is, and believe in Jesus because of what he's already done for you. If he never answers another prayer, if you're not blessed with anything above the absolute necessity from a physical standpoint ever again in your life, God still has done more for you than you deserve. And you stop and think about that. But he sort of mildly rebukes this man, letting him know, yeah, you have to see signs and wonders in order for you to believe. Yeah. Yes, that's right. And that's easy to forget. In real life, we sometimes forget about the past. You know, we often say, count your many blessings. And that's right. And that's what we ought to do. We ought to always stop once in a while, even when we're not asking for anything, in praying, whatever, just stop and remember how much God has done for us. Even start writing stuff down. That's a healthy exercise. Just to remember and reflect. You know, I remember God did this and did that and this and this and this and that. And think of how much you have been blessed. But when real life strikes, sometimes you're not really thinking. You should, and I should. But sometimes it's easy to forget about what he has done in the past. It's almost like, you know, the old saying, what have you done for me lately? And sometimes we have that approach even. As brash as that may sound, sometimes we have that approach even with God. What have you done for me lately? Oh, I know what you did for me 20 years ago, but what about now? And Jesus, again, is indicating sometimes we get to the point where if we don't see it, and sometimes on an ongoing basis, then it affects our faith. And I'm just saying from this passage that we should think about ourselves when we read what he says to this man with regard to this. But fortunately for him, Jesus does heal his son. So at verse 49, it says, the official said to him, sir, and it's almost as if he kind of blocked out that last point. He said to him, sir, come down before my child dies. And Jesus said to him, go, your son will live. And the man believed the word that Jesus spoke to him and went on his way. And so that had to be, you know, quite amazing to him. And again, he shows he has faith. Jesus just said, just go. It's done. And he believes. But he must have been thinking, even though he didn't articulate, he must have been thinking, wow, he doesn't even have to come back home with me. He didn't have to come back to Capernaum. All he has to do is speak it and think it, and it's done. But he believed, when Jesus said that, he believed that it would be so. And interestingly enough, again, it says at verse 51, and as he was going down, his servants met him and told him that his son was recovering. So his servants are back home, of course, taking care of his dying boy as he tries to get some help. And now all of a sudden his son is healed, and he's no longer dying. They could tell that. So they start heading towards their master. Master's heading back home now. But they're going to him to tell him, your son is recovering. Of course, his son wasn't recovering. His son was recovered. His son was healed. And but they, you know, he had a high a fever. It's indicated here, and probably the fever broke, and they may not even have been thinking, man, he's been miraculously healed. It's just, you know, he's getting better. All of a sudden, that fever has dropped. Fever gone away, and they want to go tell the master, not realizing he's not recovering. He's healed. Yeah. So, okay, yeah. How did you see that? But that's okay. I'm up here. I can't even see it, and you can look back. Okay. Yes. Yes. That's right. Yes. That's a good one. Yeah. It's interesting in that particular occasion, at the end of that, Jesus said to that centurion, I've not seen as much faith in all of Israel than that. So he really had faith. He believed from the start, all he has to do is speak the word. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And all of us are susceptible to that. You know, all of us, none of us have perfect faith. And that's why passages like this can help all of us as we stop and reflect. And you know, we read these wonderful stories in the Gospels and throughout the Bible. We ought to think of ourselves. These things ought to, you know, what Jesus says to them, I wonder if that's applicable to me. I wonder if I'm like that, or if I would be like that, or in these Bible stories, that's why they're written, so to help us, so that we have a stronger kind of faith. But you're absolutely right. I mean, we see all the time people it seems like it's out of the blue, but we don't know what's going on behind the scenes. But people who apparently are faithful Christians, and just out of nowhere to us, it seems like, boy, they quit. And we don't know what's going on behind the scenes. And sometimes it's things like that. Things happen in their life that it just causes them to lose faith. And we wish that never ever happened, but it does. The question is, will you allow it to happen to you at any point in time? Yes, Barbara. Yeah. Yes. Yes. And very good. And that's what Hebrews chapter 12 is all about, showing us that we never have an excuse. Whatever it is, we don't have an excuse for losing our faith. We can finish the race. We have that cloud of witnesses, all who went through terrible persecution and suffering and tragedy in their life, and they made it. So the Hebrew writer is saying, so can we. And they're the evidence of that. So there's never any excuse. And I want to make sure we're clear on that. But real life does happen, and sometimes even folks like you and me give up and lose the faith. And so we can't take anything for granted. You have to be determined and make it your fixed purpose that no matter what, you're not going to. And that faith should be based, as I've been saying, on the basis of who it is that we're serving. God is God no matter what. Jesus is Jesus no matter what. No matter how many prayers he answers in your favor, and no matter how many times he says no, doesn't change who they are. And we need to realize who it is that we're serving. Okay, any hands that I miss at all? Yes, Sam. Yes, that's right. That's exactly right. His will is going to be accomplished, and so that's right. It's good attitude to have. All right, so he's heading back home. This and again, they're thinking this young man is recovering. But notice verse 52 says, and so he asked them the hour when he began to get better. And they said to him, yesterday at the seventh hour, the fever left him. You know what happened when that fever left him? He wasn't getting better. He was healed. But that's the exact time when Jesus spoke to the man and said, go, you know, your son is healed. And so that in itself is faith building to them. It says the father knew that that was the hour when Jesus had said to him, your son will live. And he himself believed, and watch, in all his household, that would include those servants that are now coming to meet him saying, your son is recovering. Now they put it all together. He said, well, what time was that? When that happened, about the seventh hour, you know, that's exactly when Jesus said to me that your son is healed. And that just instilled faith in all of them. They began to see just how powerful God really is. And so a wonderful story. You can see why John put this one in his gospel. What is he trying to do? Trying to show us Jesus is indeed the Christ. He's the one that we need to believe in with all of our heart, soul, and mind. Stories like this help us do that. Yes, Greg. Yes. Yes. Yes, yes. Gave him that real solid faith that, again, I think I mentioned last week or week before, whenever, that there are different degrees of faith. And this fella obviously shows that. But when he put that all together, it just really validated everything. And they understand exactly who Jesus is. And so, again, help them with their faith. And so, says this was now the second sign that Jesus did when he had come from Judea to Galilee. All right, so that's chapter 4. And we get into chapter 5 then tonight. And as I said earlier, it seems as you read this, in fact, in the ESV, chapter 5 simply begins by saying, after this, there was a feast of the Jews. I think some translations say after these things, something along those lines. And so if you're just reading that, you're just reading a lot. In fact, I have a very good commentary who specifically says here, and it's pretty reliable commentary, actually. I get a lot out of it. But here it says upon this statement, after this, he says, is referring to the events of chapter 4. Well, I guess technically that's true, but that's not what he meant. That what is about to happen in this healing at the pool of Bethesda and all that is directly following what we just talked about, what we just read, and the healing of the nobleman's son and all of that. But it didn't. There are several months, maybe a year, in between chapter 4 and chapter 5. After he leaves Cana, he goes to Nazareth, his hometown, where he said a prophet is never honored. That's where he goes after he leaves Cana. Turn over again to the book of Luke. Luke chapter 4, and see the rest of that. And at verse 16, we read verse 14 where it says he returned in the power of the Spirit to Galilee. That in the power of the Spirit has to do with his miraculous work that he did, the healings and all of that. But down at verse 16 says then, and he came to Nazareth where he had been brought up, and as was his custom, he went into the synagogue on the Sabbath day, and he stood up to read. And the scroll of the prophet Isaiah was given to him, and he unrolled the scroll and found the place where it was written, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor, and he has sent me to proclaim liberty to the captives and recovering of the sight to the blind, and to set at liberty those who are oppressed, and to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. And he rolled up the scroll and gave it back to the attendant and sat down. That's good preaching right there if we want to really get into Luke chapter 14, which we won't tonight. But you could just visualize Jesus going into the synagogue and them handing him a scroll and him reading that prophecy and then rolling it back up and giving it to him. And he indicates in there, that's me. This passage is talking about me. And so it's real powerful stuff. But anyway, that's where he goes. He goes to Nazareth. Then turn over to Matthew chapter 4. In Matthew chapter 4, And at verse 12 says, "And now when he had heard that John had been arrested," we read that from Mark a while ago, "he withdrew into Galilee." And then watch. Then at verse 13, even here in Matthew, it skips a whole lot of stuff. The very next verse says, "in leaving Nazareth." So Matthew has him getting there and then leaving very quickly. And a lot of stuff happened in between verse 12 and 13. But he leaves Nazareth. It says, "leaving Nazareth, he went and he lived in Capernaum by the sea in the territory of Zebulun and Naphtali." Now, he's going to be there for at least a year in Capernaum. He's going to live there. That's going to be his headquarters, so to speak. And all kind of stuff happens. He goes into synagogues and preaches. He heals a lot of people, including Peter's mother-in-law. He chooses his disciples here. Verse 18 says, and walking by the Sea of Galilee, he saw two brothers, Simon, who is called Peter, and Andrew, his brother, casting a net into the sea, for they were fishermen. And he said to them, "Follow me, and I will make you fishers of men." Immediately they left their nets and followed him. And going on from there, he saw two other brothers, James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother. And so he calls those four disciples. And then he actually then from Capernaum goes on his first circuit of Galilee, and accomplishes all kinds of things, does all kinds of preaching and healing and all of that. And all of that happens between John 4 and John 5. And so when you read that after this, I'm not just talking about what just happened with the nobleman's son. A lot of things transpire. And depending on what position you take, it could be. Let's get into, we won't be able to get too far, but let's get into chapter 5, what it says there. It says, and now, let's see, it says, after this, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Now, one thing we can't know here is what feast he's talking about there. All kind of debates have been talked about. People have taken many different positions. The early days, scholars took the position that this is referring to the Passover. Others think it's Tabernacles and even some less significant feast. I would lean towards it being the Passover. But if it is, remember in John chapter 2, Jesus, that's what took him to Jerusalem in the first place, going to the Passover. And so if this is a Passover, that's a whole year later. And then in chapter 6 at verse 4, we have another reference to a Passover. If this feast is the Passover, then the one in 6 is the third Passover, which when you put it all together would mean that his personal ministry lasted over, about just a little over 3 years. And that's what most conclude. And so this probably is a reference to the Passover, but I wouldn't be dogmatic at all about that. And you have scholars on both sides, some proving it absolutely is, and this is why. And well, it absolutely is not, and this is why. It's the only time that when Jesus goes up for a feast, it's not specifically named. And don't have any idea why that is, but we can't really be sure. But the point of it is, a lot of time has passed. So after this, he goes to a feast of the Jews, and he goes up to Jerusalem, and there was in Jerusalem by the sheep gate a pool in the Aramaic called Bethesda, which has five roof colonnades. Now, we won't, our time is about up, so the bell, second bell is going to ring. We'll get into this next week. The sheep gate was on the northern side, northeast side of Jerusalem, probably in the wall of Jerusalem there. And this pool under consideration is somewhere near that location. I think someone has said there's at least six locations that people have tried to narrow it down into. And so, we're not going to get bogged down with that at all. But there was a situation where people would be taken to this pool. And every once in a while, the water would be troubled, and people believed that it was an angel doing that, and that the first one into the water would be healed. We'll get into that again next week. There were a lot of people there who believed that that was absolutely the case. They wanted to be the first one into that water. I'll just tell you in passing right now, there was no angel troubling that water. And It just, that it was more, that was based more on superstition. It's in the text. It was probably a scribal note that was meant to be in the margin that worked its way into the text over the years. It's not found in the best Greek manuscripts that we have. In fact, the ESV doesn't even mention that. If you have the ESV, it says, in these laid a multitude of invalids, blind, lame, and paralyzed. And then you notice in the ESV, it goes from 3 to 5. Kind of odd when you see that in the Bible. But the ESV doesn't have a John 5:4. It just goes from 3 to 5. Because verse 4, the last part of verse 3 and the entirety of verse 4 isn't in the best manuscripts that we have. And so it really doesn't belong there. It's in the King James and some others, but it really doesn't belong there. It's just a scribal explanation of why the people are laid at this pool. And so this sort of interesting there. We'll talk more about that and look at this great miracle that takes place on this occasion. We'll do that next week. Appreciate your attention.